And I love Mike Masters around like the future human extratempestrial hypothesis, right? The one thing I'd add to that is like, okay, for any person out there who has kids, right? Ask yourself, who loves you more, your child or your parent? You know, does your mom love you more than your child? And the answer is, you know, your kid will, you know, they love you. They don't love you like your mom loves you, right? If somehow our consciousness exists independently of our bodies and can exist over time, who's more likely to come back and try to help you? Your dead mom or your future child? I'm not saying the great, 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 great grandson isn't coming back in a time machine and helping, but it just seems to me that if consciousness persists, that when I die, you don't think I'm going to try to help my great grandkids if I can? Like, you better believe I am.
Welcome back to Cosmosis. I'm your host, J. Christopher King, along with my wonderful co-host, Kelly Chase. Before we begin, I just wanted to say that we've been blown away by the response to our first episode with Courtney LaFall. Thank you for all the incredible feedback and for being part of this conversation. We're so glad this show is resonating and that you enjoy the new format. There's so much more to come. If you're just tuning in, this new podcast is a project that grew out of the recent docuseries from our media company, Ontocalypse Productions, called Cosmosis, UFOs in a New Reality. After spending more than a year working on the TV show, we realized that there was so much more to say about the concepts and stories we discussed there. So we created this podcast to allow us to take a deeper dive, to continue the exploration we began there, and to bring you more directly into this process of discovery.
But don't worry. You don't need to have seen the Cosmosis docuseries to follow along with the podcast. We created it to be self-contained and able to stand on its own. But if you like what you hear, we hope you'll check the docuseries out. It's currently available on Amazon Prime, Apple TV, Fandango at Home, Vimeo, YouTube, and more. You can find all the links at cosmosis.media. And if you want to support the show and help us keep these conversations going, join us on Patreon. Patrons get early access to ad-free episodes and more. You can find all the details at patreon.com/cosmosismedia. In our last episode, Courtney shared the incredible history of anomalous experiences in his family, stories passed down through generations that shaped his understanding of reality. In this episode, we go even deeper. What does it mean to integrate the anomalous into everyday life? How do these experiences change us? Not just in how we think, but in how we move through the world. But before we get to that conversation, here's a clip from Cosmosis, UFOs in a New Reality, in which Courtney tells the fascinating story of a UFO encounter that he had with his wife. Check it out.
We were driving back home. We decided to take the long way, kind of the back roads, and we're driving, and we're probably about halfway back, and we see a light in the sky. It's kind of out of nowhere, just appears, and then it, you know, it stops and it moves over to the other side of the road. We see it stop again, go up, go, you know, back down, and you know, we're saying, "Did you see that? Did you see that?" She's like, "Yeah, I saw it." And we're kind of tracking it, but we're inside the car, and it would seem like whichever way we tried to go to get a glimpse of it, it went the other way and made it hard for us. And it was almost like there was some intelligent control of whatever it was we're seeing. You know, when we kind of compared notes about what we saw, the interesting thing was we both saw something, but we both also kind of described it
very differently.
We both saw something luminous. We both saw something that had structure to it. It was nighttime, so it was kind of hard to make it out. But she said she saw something that was more cylindrical in shape. I thought I saw something that was more triangular in shape. What shape it was, I don't know if that really even matters. I think what matters is, you know, we're leaving here and we saw something that didn't make sense to us.
So we spent a lot of time in the last episode kind of talking about your family history and the history of the ranch that your family lives on. I'd love to kind of take a lot of that stuff and put it more into context, because there's so much to talk about when we talk about experiencers and experiencer narratives. Something that I'm really curious about is that, you know, something that drew us to your story is that it's not really your typical experiencer story, at least not as it's conveyed to us through kind of the typical disclosure paradigm. Mm-hmm. What does that all look like to you as someone where anomalous experience is such sort of an everyday part of your life, or a very common part of your life and a part of your family's history? Kind of what does disclosure look like to you? Like, what stands out to you? What parts do you identify with? Is there anything that you really have questions about? I'd love to just hear your thoughts on all of that.
I guess disclosure to me is about government accountability and transparency, you know, more than anything, more so than about UFOs and aliens and, you know, NHI or any of that stuff. Like, I think to me, and I wrote a letter to my congressman about this, right? Which is that if what Dave Grush alleges and so many others allege is true, or even partially true, then that means you have a rogue element within the government that doesn't have oversight by Congress, or probably even the executive branch, and that in many ways there's a constitutional crisis. And if we are to live in the democracy that we believe we live in, then there should be some form of accountability there. To what extent is there transparency, right? Do you have to give up all the new technological toys you've developed from this technology? You know, I don't necessarily know that that's the case, but I think that the fact that there's lack of transparency to Congress and to, you know, the oversight bodies, I think that is problematic. And so for me, I see a disclosure as a, like, what we would be disclosing is that we don't live in the democracy that we think we do. And if we want to live in the democracy that we think we should live in, then you have to have disclosure, and you have to have accountability, and you have to have oversight. And so I think everybody wants to make it about NHI and black programs and CIA and all that stuff. But it's to me, it's about democracy, you know, and whether or not we live in one. And then, you know, it's the other side of that, like disclosure, in the traditional sense, I feel like, you know, you're getting disclosure from, you know, your grandma, your cousin, your sister, your uncle. You don't believe them, and you trust them more than you trust the government. So, you know, are we really going to all of a sudden enter some new paradigm just because the government comes out and admits that they've been lying for 80 years, right? Like, I mean, if you can't see that they've been lying for 80 years, then obviously you're not paying attention, right? Because everything they said about Roswell can't be true, right? It can't be a balloon and a, you know, whatever else they've, you know, kind of made up, right? So I think of it as more simple than that. Like, do we have the democracy that we want? And if so, or if not, how do we get there? And then are there institutions and entities and individuals that you trust more than the government who are telling you the same thing? And if so, then you have disclosure. Because I think both sides of UFO argument, and just the public at large, we have the lowest trust for government than we have ever had in American history. So why do we feel that if they tell us something else, all of a sudden, like, we got the truth? I believe my grandma more than I believe the government. It's just,
I think
she's lied to me less than the government.
Except about Santa Claus.
That was the first time I realized conspiracies were possible. Santa Claus wasn't real.
I think that's probably true for a lot of us. So along those lines, you know, I think this question may have already answered itself, but maybe it deserves a little bit of amplification. Are you optimistic about, like, recent and upcoming, like, disclosure and transparency efforts? How do you feel about that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm optimistic about it, right? Like, I think it's good. I think it's not going to change my worldview at all. Like, I feel like disclosure is like telling the world that water is wet. Like, we already knew that, you know? But I think what I would be more optimistic about is the fact that we're able to take our government back from the forces behind the scenes that have co-opted it, you know, for whatever purposes, right? Like, and I understand, you know, the Cold War, and, you know, you're trying to outdo Russia, you don't know, and there's, like, the civil rights movement, and, like, there's all these reasons not to disclose. I get all that. And so I'm not like angry at the people or anything like that. I just see it as, you know, did you swear an oath to the Constitution or did you swear an oath to the aerospace company? Mm-hmm. Tell me, you know? And if it's to the Constitution, then that should reign supreme. That's what makes us have a country in the first place. And so if we're subverting that and we have political leaders who are more afraid of the intelligence agencies than they are about keeping their oath to the Constitution and actually providing oversight, we don't have a democracy, right? So, or at least we don't have the democracy we thought we had, a representative republic, whatever, you know, I'm going to get technical. So I just, I'm hopeful, you know, I like what I, you know, see from some of the congressional members. I like the hearings. I think, I'll say this, right? I think some of it is performative, frankly. Like, I think if you really wanted to get, like, if you want a disclosure, you give me Dave Grush, a SCIF, a security clearance, and SEAL Team 6, and I'll have disclosure by Friday. Like, I don't think it's that hard. Like, if there are people telling us, here's who's doing it, here's where the bodies are, but for some reason you can't get them in a SCIF to get that information, and then you don't act on it, like, I mean, I don't know what else, you know, to tell you. And I get it, there's procedural things, there's, you know, you got to think about a lot of stuff. So I'm not advocating necessarily like a catastrophic disclosure situation, but I also don't think it's that complicated, right? Like, obviously there's more to it. Like, there's reasons why, you know, the select committees in the Senate haven't subpoenaed witnesses, right? There's a reason why, you know, Delta Force hadn't showed up at some deep underground military base and demanded, you know, access, right? And sure, those might be catastrophic ways to get to disclosure, but I mean, if you really want disclosure, then put Ronald Moultrie and Scott Bray under oath when they testify to Congress. Like, what's so hard about that? You know?
Yeah.
If you really want disclosure, then somebody ask President Trump to reinstate Dave Grush's security clearance so he can go into a SCIF and share the information. Haven't heard anybody ask for that, right? So I think there's, to me, I think there's a lack of just practical, like, get to the bottom of it. Like, and to me, that's what's concerning, because it makes me ask the question of, like, what powers are at play that make it such that Congress doesn't want to subpoena people or can't form a select committee to subpoena people? You know, what powers are at play that you put things in the NDAA that you know are going to get the bill killed, like, you know, eminent domain, when the government already has eminent domain? You know, like, it just seems like there's like a performative element and almost like a self-sabotage element. And I don't know if that's intentional or if it's unintentional, but it seems like if you want to get the answers, you get Gabe Grush in a SCIF, you get, you know, you get your elite units, you give people 48 hours to fess up or face the consequences, and then you got disclosure.
In the show, we cover two of your different UFO sightings, one when you were young with your grandma, another one that you had more recently with your wife. And, you know, what I think is so interesting about that is that there's also so much more to your story beyond just those UFO sightings. How do you relate UFO sightings to the high strangeness and other things that go on in your life? Because when we look at things through the lens of disclosure, it's through this military intelligence lens. And so we're talking about something that's coming here from somewhere else for reasons that make sense to us. It's like military reasons or scientific reasons or exploratory reasons. But like, how do you sort of interpret that maybe differently than it's interpreted through that lens with your own experience?
Yeah. So I guess my experience, I mean, look, I have a lot of military members serving my family, right? So I definitely get that perspective, and I don't want to imply that I don't, right? And I got clients that are military and defense contractors too, so I don't want to, you know, say that. But I think from my vantage point, it never appeared to me directly through that lens, right? Like, when I saw the sighting with my grandma, I always questioned whether it was even a UFO, because it wasn't a flying saucer that I saw, it was more of an orb, right? And that the word orb hadn't even entered the conversation at that point in time. And, you know, I remember even being a teenager or kid, and you have those little sleepover conversations of, have you ever seen a UFO? It's like, well, no, but I saw this thing, you know? And so I don't know that I ever even put my experiences in that box, right? Like precognitive dreams and near-death experience. I didn't even know what a near-death experience was. And, you know, even after I had had two, like I still went and like, I just didn't have the language for it, right? So I think part of it is just having experiences stuff outside of the lens and outside of the disclosure context just gave me a different view. And then I always knew, I mean, that the government had secret things. And like my view on, you know, reverse engineering, I guess we can allow to talk about that now, right? Is like, you better be reverse engineering something that fell in Roswell. Like, you know, like if I were Congress, I'd be like, what do you mean you have stuff flying around in the sky? You don't know what it is and you haven't tried to reverse engineer it. Like that would be the dumbest thing I ever heard of. Right. So you, the idea that the government wouldn't be investigating this topic or wouldn't be reverse engineering this technology or wouldn't be doing all the things that we suspect that they're doing, like, just flip it on its head and say, why on earth would you not do that if you had a blank check from the U.S. taxpayer? Like, of course you're going to do it. Like, you better do it. Like, as a taxpayer, you better be reverse engineering this stuff, right? So I kind of lost sight of the question, Kelly, but I think the idea to me is, like, my worldview isn't beholden to the disclosure government worldview. And, like, I just kind of came into it from a different lens and a different angle. And I still respect what's happening from that standpoint. I respect the government's perspective on a lot of these issues. But I don't necessarily know that we need them for disclosure. Like, I got disclosure when I was looking at the sky with my grandma, not from Congress, right?
We'll be right back after this quick break.
So along those lines, Courtney, I guess one big question here. You know, we all support more transparency, these initiatives, disclosure, et cetera. And as we've talked about on Cosmosis, it's also important to bring more people to the table, whether that's private industry, academia. It seems like this is kind of an all-in situation where we can all bring our gifts and really to really push the ball forward in a way. And maybe it does require all of us and all of our special gifts. Do you think, along those lines, do you think that we have the faculties available to us and the resources necessary to figure all this out? You know, part of that maybe is defining for the sake of conversation, which this we're talking about, you know, is it ufology? Is it mediumship? Is it, you know, psi abilities? But I think you see where I'm going. Can we tackle these mysteries? What's your take on that?
So my take is, do we have the faculties? If that's the question, the answer is yes. But I think the question I would probably ask is, like, do we have the framework? And I think the answer is no. And I tweeted this a while back. I said, it's not just the government. Our entire society is siloed, compartmentalized, you know, and apartmented or whatever. And the idea is that what you need is, you need all of them, right? You need religion, you need science, you need technology, you need, you know, philosophy, you need, you know, experiencers, you need everybody. But the problem I think we have with our society is that everybody has to be in their own silos. It's science over here, religion over there. It's, you know, philosophers over here and engineers over there. And it's, you know, experiences over here and, you know, reverse engineering and crash retrievals over there, right? And it's the minute you cross streams, you're a heretic on both sides, right? And I think that's the problem. It's that we need philosophers and scientists sitting down with experiencers and engineers to figure this out. And as long as we're looking down our nose at each other, we're never going to be able to solve the mystery. And I think that might be the point, right? Everybody seems to believe, right? Whether you're a religious person, you believe, hey, we need to have a new spiritual awakening and evolve our you know, souls and spirits. If you're, you know, kind of the, call it the secular woo, it's all about your consciousness and elevating your consciousness. If you're a scientist, it's like about the next discovery. And if you're an engineer, it's like, how do I, you know, make the next thing? And it's like, we're all kind of pursuing this next level of our own respective domains. But I think the next level is that we have to be able to integrate across those various streams. And, you know, it's for the religious person to not look down their nose at the scientist, you know, who's looking at the world through an irrational lens, and for the scientist to not look down at the religious person who's looking at the world from the religious lens, because they might be able to learn from each other. And, you know, maybe you need each other, and maybe that's where the next discovery is from, is it's, you know, and that's what innovation is. It's fusion, right? It's taking a little bit of this, a little bit of that, mixing it together, and now you have something better than the sum of its parts. And I think that's what's missing in our society, is that we haven't given ourselves the license to, you know, be able to cross streams and integrate. And if you, you know, talk about this to your church friends, you're a heretic, right? If you talk about this to your science friends, you're a heretic. If you talk about this, you know, and I just think that's the problem with our society. And like, and until we can start to break down those silos and break down those walls, I don't think we can solve the mystery. Like, we need each other, and we need all those perspectives, and we need more people who can cross streams, right? It's like Gary Nolan was an experiencer before he was a scientist, right? Mm-hmm. And like, I think a lot of people forget that. And it's like, you know, I don't know, maybe one has something to do with the other, and maybe those two things overlap. They sure seem to for him, and he seems to be pretty darn good at what he does. And I think you need more people like that.
I think that makes a ton of sense. And it kind of makes me think about, you know, we're dealing with this at a cultural level, but in some ways we have to like take a step back maybe and deal with it at the individual level. You know, something that Jay and I talk about all the time is that, you know, there's all of this sort of, there's this paradigm where people are identify as experiencers or not experiencers. But the reality of the situation is, like, if you really talk to people, that almost everyone you talk to either has had an experience that they really can't explain, or someone very close to them, someone close enough that they believe that they're not lying to them, even if they can't make sense of it, has had that kind of an experience. And so maybe part of what we have to go through to get to that point at the cultural level is at the individual level, we have to be able to start to integrate these, our own experiences, before we can even start to, you know, reach out to other people and make sense of theirs. So, you know, coming from a family that in some ways is kind of native to this space of acceptance and integration, what advice would you have for people who are, you know, just now waking up to this, who are maybe identifying that they have had anomalous experiences, even if they haven't identified that way before? Like, what, how do we move forward? Like, how do you start to integrate that?
Yeah, I think the first thing that comes to mind is acceptance, right? It's like, I mean, it's the first step in the 12-step program. It's like, you kind of got to accept the fact that you've had this experience, and that it's real, and you have to be honest with yourself, right? And I think a lot of times it's not that, you know, we're lying to each other, it's that we're lying to ourselves, right? And I think if you're struggling with these experiences, it's okay to acknowledge that it happened to you and that it's real. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to go and flip your whole worldview and quit your job and, you know, and I think that's what people get afraid of, and rightfully so. I understand it. It's like, if I believe that this is real, I remember I had a conversation with one of my best friends about this. He's like, well, if that's true, that means our government has been lying to us and doing this and they're doing that. And it's like, I don't live in the fairy tale that I thought I lived in. It's like, yeah, that is what that means, right? And I think that's hard for people to accept. But I think you can take it one step at a time. You can accept yourself. You can accept your experience. You can accept, you know, your reality. But that doesn't mean you got to go to Washington, D.C. with pitchforks and, you know, demand transparency necessarily. And I think that's where we get stuck. It's like, if the scientist accepts the fact that there are some anecdotes that seem to have merit, that doesn't mean we got to throw out science, you know, and that doesn't mean that that doesn't mean that there's not a scientific explanation for what they're talking about that we haven't discovered yet. And it doesn't mean that your life work is wrong. You know, it doesn't mean that you're a bad person because you ridiculed this topic for 10 years. It's another data point. And I think that's where people struggle. It's like, if I accept that angels might be real, then maybe I now have to live my life a different way. And it's like, you don't have to, you know, it's, you know, you can accept your reality and then make a choice how you want, what you want to do after that. But I think that's part of the problem. It's like, we're trying to swallow the whole elephant at once, and you just gotta, you gotta take one bite and accept what the reality in front of you, and then decide on what the next step is going to be.
That makes so much sense. You know, my old friend, Stuart Davis, who is a co-founder of the Experiencer Group, he used to say that we need to take the high road when we're dealing with anomalous experiences and non-human intelligence in general. You know, I think that there are a lot of ways to interpret that, and he'd like to riff on that line quite a bit. You know, along those lines, would you agree with that? Do we need to take the high road, or does that seem like the best road to take? Like, what does that bring to mind for you in terms of methodology or strategy for dealing with these situations in the moment, afterwards, or even maybe like preparing oneself for a form of contact or disclosure, etc.?
Yeah, I think, I mean, when you said, should we take the high road? I'm like, what other road should we take, right? Like, you know, it's like, I think we as, I don't know what you want to call us, believers, experiencers, whatever, you know, I think we're going to have a tough choice to make too, you know, particularly if there is disclosure. Are we going to be the ones that thumb our nose at everyone and say, I told you so, and blah, 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 blah? Like, is that the path we're going to take? Or are we going to take the high road and say, hey, welcome, you know, I've been in this reality for a while now. Here's things to watch out for. Here's the things to be concerned about. Oh, yeah, here's a data point. Actually, you're a scientist. Can you look at this for me? And I think that's the road and the path that you should take in general, like whether it's NHI or whatever. You know, when we discover the things that our government has done, that the misdeeds, you know, are we going to, you know, riot in the street and throw out the best form of government that probably has ever existed? Or are we going to say, you know what, like, we made mistakes. Let's figure out how to make our system more resilient. Let's figure out how to, you know, have accountability. Let's understand the other perspective. We can still have justice and do all those things, but I think that's the only role. And I think that's the point of all of this, right? Like, I think once you get deep enough into this, from whichever angle you come, you know, everyone I've encountered that has come to grips with this and started integrating it, they always come back to the same point of like, oh, now I want to be a better person. And now I want to, you know, I have more empathy in my heart. I care more about animals. I care more about the planet. I care more about my fellow human being. And that's from people on the religious end of the spectrum and the secular end of the spectrum. They're all kind of saying the same thing. And I think there's something to that. And I think that might be part of what this is all about in terms of us as human beings becoming better individuals so that we can become a better society.
Definitely. You know, in Cosmosis, we talk about the different theories about, you know, what could be behind the UFO phenomenon. And what was so cool about your story is it allowed us to kind of access other parts of that that don't usually get talked about. You know, we talk about, you know, future humans or ultra-terrestrials or extraterrestrials, but what we don't usually talk about, but it seems to be such a huge part of experience or narratives, is that this also seems to have something to do with the dead, the afterlife, communications from dead relatives and ancestors, you know, the things you're talking about, you know, religion and spiritual concerns and spiritual impulses. All of that seems to be tied up in this. So with all of that in mind, and just based on your own experiences and what you've observed, what do you think our relationship is to whatever this is, these non-human intelligences?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the interesting thing, right, is, and I love Mike Masters, you know, around like the future human extratempestrial hypothesis, right? The one thing I'd add to that is like, okay, for any person out there who has kids, right? Ask yourself, who loves you more, your child or your parent? You know, does your mom love you more than your child? And the answer is, you know, your kiddo, you know, they love you. They don't love you like your mom loves you, right? And like, okay, so what does that mean? If somehow we can traverse time, right? If somehow our consciousness exists independently of our bodies and can exist over time, who's more likely to come back and try to help you? Your dead mom or your future child? Is it going to be your dead grandma or your great-great-grandson that's going to come back and try to help you? I'm not saying the great-great-great-great-grandson isn't coming back in a time machine and helping, but it just seems to me that if consciousness persists, that when I die, you don't think I'm going to try to help my great-grandkids if I can? Like, you better believe I am. And, you know, I think if you take a lot of this, you know, if you take just, you know, what we often accept, right? Consciousness is non-local and all these things. If you take all that, I think it has to include your ancestors too in the conversation, not necessarily to exclude anyone else, but or any other hypotheses. I just think that hypothesis has to be included because as humans, we all would, you know, try to help our child or grandchild if we could from the other side. Like, I think it would just be a natural impulse. So to me, that's the most logical. You know, we know that they existed, right? Like, and we know that they love us and we know that they have a vested interest in our future. And we know that any of us would try to help if we could. So why do we think that, you know, our ancestors wouldn't? I have one skeptical friend ask me, well, why does your great-grandparents, you know, seem to want to interact with you more than mine want to interact with me? If it's real, why don't mine interact with me more than yours? I don't know. Maybe my grandparents love me more than yours love you. I don't know. You know, and that's just me being kind of a jerk about it. But I think that there's something, you know, authentic in that, right? Like maybe there is something there, and I certainly believe that. And like I think most cultures believe that. Most cultures believe that their ancestors are still with us and like still look after us and they watch over us and they care about us. I'll tell you guys a little anecdotal story. We joined a new church, you know, this is a few years ago. We joined a new church and my son was going, you know, to the children's church. And after church one day, one of the teachers in the children's church comes up to me and she was like, oh my gosh, like your son is so great. I love him so much. He's like, he's like one of my favorite kids. And like, I don't know if you guys know this, but he's like really good at math, just the way he thinks. And like, and he hadn't even started school yet. And so she's like going on about math and like how he's so, and I just started getting a sense of my grandmother's sister who, you know, passed away, you know, like 2006, I think. And so I just started like almost like feeling her presence and like just thinking about her and like it's just like this overwhelming sense of her, right? Like that I probably hadn't felt or sensed just before she passed away. And then I stopped. I said, you know, I know this is weird, but I've never heard anybody talk this passionately about math and the kid like since my, you know, great aunt, you know, used to talk to me. She had a master's in mathematics. She was a math teacher, you know, one of the big high schools in Dallas. And I told her this and she said, well, you know, what's your aunt's name? And so I told her her name. I said, well, she used to teach at this school. This is her name. And she literally almost starts crying. She's like, oh my God, like I took over her classroom when she retired.
Whoa.
And so I'm teaching in her classroom, teaching the same subject. And somehow she had just got this connection to my child, right? And and he had been talking about wanting to do robotics and like wanting to do like make a robot. And then she's like, oh, you want to do robotics? Well, we just came back from the robotics competition. We won the state competition. Like I got the robot in the car. Like, let's go out to the car and like go look at the robot. And it's like, what is the statistical probability like that that can happen? And so do I think, you know, my great aunt is looking out for my son? Absolutely. You know, and is there something that drew us to that church and drew him to her and her to him, and the math and the robotics, and like in the same classroom, the same, you know, it's like, how do you even make that happen, even if you wanted to? So that's just one anecdote, but I think there's something to it.
It's really profound. It's incredibly profound. I mean, just the kind of like level of things that have to come together, and the amount of context that you bring to the situation, and the way that that's able to kind of engender this realization is absolutely fantastic. And it gets back to that thing about how a lot of people, they just don't know their personal history. They don't know their family history. They haven't, you know, I have moved all over the place. You know, I've only lived in the town that I'm in right now for 2 years. You know, those kinds of connections. And I feel like, you know, is there an element, if high strangeness, if the fabric of reality is kind of in a dialogue with us,
mm-hmm.
is in a dialogue with us in a specific way, you know, is there an aspect of that where it has to work a little bit harder for somebody like me that starts carpet bagging my way all around the country? You know what I'm saying?
Well, maybe, but I think it's like, okay. I mean, at one point we lived in North Carolina, right? And this is right before my son was born. And then after he was born, it was like, you know, we got to move back to Texas, right? Like, I don't, you know exactly why, but this is what we got to do. And so I think sometimes that nudge, you know, maybe that's part of it too. It's like, okay, something nudged us back here. And then that is what caused us to have to look for a new church, which also, you know, opens up the possibility for buying this ranch and like all these other things that happen. And you could probably trace it back to these little bitty, you know, nudges that happen along the way. And I don't even know that I don't think the phenomenon has to work that hard. I think it's just like, do we listen to the little nudges? And I think a lot of times we don't. A lot of times I don't. And then like, you know, I don't listen to it. The next thing I know, like, you know, something happens. I'm like, oh, dang, I should have done that. You know, something told me to do this and I didn't do it, you know. Yeah, I just think that's part of it.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know, switching gears a tiny little bit, and it almost feels reductive to bring it back to this kind of a level, but a lot has been happening lately. There is a connection here. A lot has been happening lately with the recent Jake Barber story put forward by Ross Coulthart about contractor retrieval teams using human-initiated contact protocols to try to summon contact with non-human intelligence. Have you spent any time on that news? And if so, what's your take on that? I mean, we're talking about this kind of talkback format and the way that we receive information, the way that we can get into a feedback situation with, quote-unquote, the phenomena in a larger framework in some ways. But in terms of that, human-initiated contacts, E5, things like that, have you spent any time on that news? And what's your take on human-initiated contact in that kind of format in general with regard to your personal history? Regardless of one way or the other, yeah, what are your thoughts on human-initiated contact?
Yeah, okay, so have I followed the story? Yes, I have. And I mean, I think Jake Barber's telling the truth, you know? You know, here's what I say about that, right? There's a lot of people who have firsthand experience with CE5 and other contact modalities, right? There's people who don't even call it CE5, who, you know, are looking up in the sky and thinking about whatever they're thinking about, and then something shows up, right? So I think that that is real, right? And if that is real, or at least there's anecdotal evidence that would suggest that it's real. And if that's the case, then I think the government, if they're smart, which they are, would use that and exploit that. Like, I mean, I would expect that if, you know, if you're taking my tax dollars and there's, you know, some evidence that this thing might work, I would fully expect you to go put together a team of people to go try to summon these things and reverse engineer it. Like, why wouldn't you do that? I think it would be irresponsible for the government not to do that. So I fully believe that's happening, or it should happen, or it will happen. What is my personal belief? I had family members say, hey, let's go out to the ranch and, you know, do some CE5 and summon some stuff. And I'm like, nope, not with me. You know, I got enough stuff showing up without summoning anything. I don't think I need to summon anything. So I personally would say that, and maybe this is, you know, I'm coming from a position of, you know, luxury here, if you want to call it that, like, where if you've had enough experiences to where you know it's real and you believe it's real, and you don't feel the need to go and try to bring it upon yourself any more than it already is, right? So that's my stance on that part. The other part of it is, I don't think it's all 100% benevolent, if we want to use that terminology, right? Like, you know, is what happened to my cow benevolent? I don't know, maybe, like in the grand scheme of things, might it have let me and Kelly together, but is it still traumatic to find an animal like that? Absolutely. Do I want to bring more of that to my life? No, not at all. Are the dreams that my son was having leading up to the purchase of the ranch, like, where he's, you know, and I could give you some of them, like, freaking out and seeing things, and some of which, you know, manifested in real life, right? Is that good or bad? You know, like my grandma calls it a blessing and a curse, right? So I don't know that, at least for me, it's necessary to try to bring more phenomenon into my life, because in my experience, it's 90% good, but maybe 10%, you know, leaves you scratching your head and not even wanting to talk about it for lack of, you know, making it happen again. If there are, you know, non-human intelligences out there, I can't imagine that their goals would always be 100% aligned with ours. Like, it just seems kind of unlikely. So I would tell people, like, I think I even said this too. It's like, in a tweet, like, you know, I wouldn't recommend jumping in the ocean, you know, while you're bleeding, and trying to summon a dolphin, you know, because there's a heck of a lot more dolphins than there are great white sharks, but I don't want to be in the ocean bleeding trying to summon a dolphin.
Oh, that's good.
You know,
that's
and good. I think that might be what's happening with some of these people, right? Like, I think there's some people who haven't had that one-on-one contact or that experience. They don't know if it's really real. They want to believe, they want to see it, they want to experience it. And I get that. 95% of the time, maybe even more, it might be really positive for them. But there's also another side to it, and people don't want to talk about that. I don't even want to talk about the other side, you know, not because, like, of secrecy, but because, like, I don't know if talking about it makes it happen more or not, right? Like, and I think if you want to read the literature and you want to understand this phenomenon, like, you can't throw out the data. You can't throw out the data that says people get abducted. You can't throw out the data that says cattle get mutilated. You can't throw out the data that says, you know, shadow beings show up at people's houses and do strange things. And, like, you can't, you know, all the precognitive dreams and things like that. Like, you can't throw that stuff out and just assume that everything is going to be all positive because you want it to be. Like, I don't necessarily want any of it, to be honest. Like, but both sides show up. And I think that's the hard part, I think, for people to grapple with and understand. And that doesn't mean that the entities you encounter in the CE5 experience that are love and light and aren't so. I'm just telling you that there's shadow beings out there, and ask me how I know, you know? So that's all I can maybe say on that.
Yeah, you know, speaking of kind of the more malevolent or darker side of this, I think it's becoming more and more a part of the conversation in the community that there are people who believe that this is all demonic And I think especially among people, even outside of kind of the UFO community, but in, you know, religious communities, you know, you yourself have a deeply religious background. It's a big part of your family and your life. So how do you kind of respond to that? This idea that, you know, obviously there are parts of it that are dark and you might even say demonic, but how do you kind of integrate your experience as a Christian and a man of faith with this kind of idea that so many people in various religious backgrounds have this idea that it's all demonic or that it's like opening the gateway to demons or something like that? Like, how does all of that strike you?
Yeah. So I think, all right. So being a Christian, growing up in the church, I mean, I go to church every Sunday. I play the piano at church. You know, I met my wife at church camp. Like, my mom's a pastor. Like, we used to do Bible drills, and I would be like the fastest one, you know, memorize all 66 books of the Bible in order and tell you, you know, all that stuff, Bible trivia. So I think there's a couple things that you learn when you, the number one thing is, like, I remember my pastor used to always say, you have to read the Bible for yourself. And I think there's a lot of narrative, especially in the Christian faith, where it's not, it's just passed down hearsay. It's not someone reading the scripture for themselves and saying, oh, this is what happened. This is someone's opinion, and they're relaying that opinion as fact. And I think that happens a lot. When you read it for yourself, what you see is orbs appear, you know, kind of like, you know, if you want to call it an orb, you want to call it a star or angel or whatever you want to call it. These balls of light show up very much like what I saw, and very much like what a lot of other people see. Entities appear, right? They sometimes give you messages. Oftentimes they tell the person, be not afraid. Why? Because they're freaked out, you know, and it's a scary experience. There's Jacob who wrestled, you know, with an angel, and the angel broke his hip. I mean, and this is a benevolent angel, right? Like, and they still broke his hip, right? Because he wanted them to bless him. You know, you have the Hebrew boys, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, and they said the fourth being appeared and looked like the Son of God, like, that shows up with them, right? Like, so the idea that, first of all, the idea that these entities don't interact with us is, like, if you're taking a biblical perspective, it's ludicrous, right? Like, I mean, it's full of that. And that most of the interactions, most of these entities seem to have our best interests in mind. Like, I mean, that also seems to be true. But then there's also the cases of, you know, cases of things that happen that aren't so good. And maybe not, maybe good for some, not good for others. Like, you know, we talk about Passover, and, you know, what is Passover? Okay, they put the blood of the lamb on the door so that, you know, the angel of death, if you want to call it that, you know, is going to come through and kill all the Egyptian people and not the Jewish people. Like, and this is like God sending that entity to murder these people. Like, how do you make sense? Is that good? Is that bad? You know, it's probably good for some, bad for others. Genesis 6, you know, talks about the Nephilim, you know, the fallen angels coming down and taking wives and having hybrid offspring. And then those offspring were the heroes of old, you know, men of renown, right? And then God causes the flood to wipe out this, you know, hybrid species that kind of got out of hand. And so what abductees say? They say, oh, these NHIs came and abducted me, took some genetic material, and then they produced some offspring, and they showed me my kids. And it's like, well, we've been saying the same story for 5,000 years. And at least from a biblical perspective, you would say that those entities that are engaged in that behavior are at least outside of the will of God, right? So if you want to call them demons, fine, you fallen angels, whatever, but some non-human intelligence that is interacting with humanity in an improper way, right? Because God tells them you're supposed to be, you know, interceding on behalf of the humans, not, you know, the other way around. So, like, I think if you look at the Bible literally or figuratively, what you take away is there are ample examples of non-human intelligence, you know, which many Christians perceive to be angels and demons, interacting with humanity in positive and negative ways. And when you look at the UFO community and experiences that people describe today, they describe non-human entities interacting with humans in positive and negative ways, right? Like, even if you get into the whole reptilian conversation, right? Like, the reptilians are the bad guys. The, you know, the Nordics are the good guys. I mean, if that doesn't sound like angels and demons, like they call the devil this a great serpent and a dragon, like it's not even the same. It's almost the same language, right? We're just calling it different things. And so, like, I guess my take on it is, this is my personal belief. I believe that there are supernatural forces out there, some that have our interests in mind, some that don't. And whether you want to call them angels, whether you want to call them demons, or whether you want to call them NHI or benevolent, malevolent, whatever name you want to call them, like, there's sharks in the ocean, just like there's dolphins. And as above, so below. Like, I would imagine that if this universe consists of multiple layers and levels of intelligence, some of them might not be great for us. Like, it just seems logical to me. Like, I don't understand why it's such a hard thing for people to comprehend that. Like, that doesn't mean a shark is evil. It just means that you don't probably want to go swimming with one unless you're in a shark cage, you know, and you have some protection around you. And I think that's, you know, that's my same view on the phenomena.
That makes a ton of sense. Your cultural heritage, not just your family's exceptional history, but American Black experience is, of course, it's baked into all of this. You join a relatively short list of Black men in the field of anomalous studies, so far anyway, especially from the lens of ufology, who've come forward to share their history. I think it's clear to just about anyone that has heard about your case, we need more stories, more data from people that come from diverse backgrounds for all sorts of different reasons. Can you talk a bit about where you are with that particular conversation from your perspective? Can you help, you know, lay that out for us in a better way that can help folks that aren't used to listening to that conversation?
Yeah, I think it's interesting, right? Because I think on one hand, there's a perception that, like, somehow anomalous events are somehow less prevalent, you know, in the Black community, you know, and that perception may exist because there's less of a presence of people like me talking about it, right? But I think it's full of these types of experiences, right? Like, I think not giving out too much. I mean, but there's so many sayings and, you know, belief systems that are kind of embedded, you know, in the culture that people almost take it for granted. Like, and I think that's also part of where the angels and demons narrative comes from, right? Like, I've never talked to someone that said, you know, like in my immediate circle that said, I don't believe that stuff happened, right? Like, no one says they don't believe it. They say, like, I don't know, that seems demonic, or that's evil. They don't say it didn't happen, or that it's not real, or that it's not that, you know, our ancestors don't look out for us, or that we don't have precognitive dreams. Like, I've never heard anybody even remotely say that. Like, I've heard people say, like, I don't want to go to the ranch because I know it's real, and I don't want to experience any of that, right? Like it's more of that. I think part of the reason why, and if I were to give a reason why, is probably has to do with the fact that, you know, if you don't, the conversation isn't always framed from the vantage, like me coming into the ufology community, if I say that again, like I didn't come from it from a world of like terminology like NDEs and NHIs and, you know, all the other alphabet soup that we have in the community, right? Like, it was, you know, it wasn't like, oh, you know, your son had a precognitive dream. Like, no one said that, right? Like, people would say at church, they'd say, oh, he's been here before. Like that's their way of saying, like, there's something anomalous and special about this kid that may be precognitive or something like that. They say, like, oh, he's been here before. So I think the language and the vernacular and the things like that are just different. It's just a cultural, you know, distinction there. And so I think that probably serves as a barrier to some extent. But Black people see UFOs, you know, I mean, absolutely, you know, Daniel Elizondo texted me the other day, cause we were having a conversation. He texted me an excerpt. I don't know if he minds me saying this on this show, but he texted me an excerpt from, I believe it was one of Frederick Douglass's books where he describes a UFO sighting. And I'm like, wait a minute, I didn't know about this in Black History Month. Like, what? Like, that's wow. crazy. And obviously, he didn't call it a UFO. It was like a ball of light or fire. I'll pull it up and send it to you guys. But I think it's there. It's always been there. It's just been framed differently. And I think also, you know, Black Americans are probably some of the most religious people, you know, in the country, right? And I think that religious overlay, you know, means that we'll be more likely to talk about these anomalous experiences in a church setting than in a UFO community setting, right? Like, you know, I grew up at a time where there used to be something called testimony service, right? And testimony service was like a whole service dedicated to people getting up and sharing their testimony about a miraculous event, whether it was a healing or, you know, precognition, whatever. We didn't call it that. We call it a testimony, you know, and we didn't call it being an experiencer. It was, you know, you were testifying or you were a witness, you know, right? Like, and you know, people get up at testimony service and talk about how there was a miraculous healing in their family, or so-and-so prayed and laid hands on the person and they no longer are sick, or, you know, whatever, you know, some crazy anomalous thing happened. And that was the world I grew up in. Like, I mean, so it wasn't like, you know, things weren't anomalous that didn't happen. I just didn't call them, I didn't call it an experiencer. I didn't call it a this or that. It was just, you know, surrounded in a different cultural context. And in today's kind of modern Black churches, you know, a lot of that has gone away, you know, in most denominations. Like, you don't have testimony services and people just, you know, and it's funny because I mean, I'm a musician too. So, and any other musicians out there that have played at a testimony service understand the thrill of that is. But it's this event where somebody will jump up out of the pew and just, you know, give their testimony of something miraculous that happened to them, and then break out singing a song like that nobody in the world has ever heard of. They just made it up. Maybe God gave it to them on the spot. But then somehow you miraculously know how to play it, right? Like, you all of a sudden can catch the song, play it. The congregation jumps in, starts singing it. And if no one knew any better, you might have thought that, you know, we rehearsed this thing. But somehow, some way, you got connected, you know, and what do you want to call it, consciousness or whatever. But I've seen those things happen in real life and participated. And I think that's part of the same thing. And, you know, obviously, like, my religious views, you know, I believe in Jesus and I'm a Christian and go to church and that. But I see so many parallels between what people describe on the secular side of the UFO phenomena that it's like, guys, like, we're talking about the same thing. Like, you know, you're talking about the telepathy tapes. It's like, well, how did I know how to play the song this lady just made up in real time? You know, like.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
That's amazing.
That's incredible. Yeah.
No, I mean, I think I've learned so much from your story. Gosh, I learned so much from Jay's story. You know, I think that when we talk to people and really listen to them and don't try to put our own blueprint on what they're saying to us, but just listen that and just be open to the differences in how you view the world. Because, like, I'm not a religious person, but I take so much, and I found so much value in your perspective, and that's part of your perspective. And, you know, I've gotten some flack on Twitter lately, or X or whatever we're calling it these days, for pushing back and saying, like, that there's this kind of, like, anti-religious undercurrent in a certain segment of the community that's saying, like, we can't bring religion into this at all. And I'm like, well, then you're excluding a huge segment of the population. Something like, you know, 80-85% of the world is religious. And this is a human conversation that we're having.
Yeah.
And people who are religious tend to process these things through the lens of religion, because if religion is nothing else, it's humans trying to make sense of the things that we don't understand about the world or the things that are beyond us. So that's something that I hope people take away from Cosmosis. But Courtney, I'd love to know your thoughts on just, like, what else can people do in this space? Content creators, you know, people doing podcasts, people doing documentaries, like, how do we what can we do to make this a more holistic human conversation where we're talking to all kinds of people and helping them feel like they have a place in this conversation?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. I think it's funny, right? It's like everybody wants, you know, inclusivity until it's like, you know, oh, we gotta bring the religious people into this, and now we don't want to be, you know, inclusive anymore, right? We gotta bring the abductees into the conversation. I don't know about that, you know. And I think, you know, being inclusive is like including the perspectives that are not your own and listening to those perspectives objectively. And I mean, I'll maybe speak. I don't want to speak on behalf of anyone but myself, but in my view, I think some of the pushback on the religious side of it is not the religious perspective of the experience. I think it's the misimplied and misinterpreted religious teachings, right? And so people then feel like if I have to listen to someone who perceives this experience as an angel or whatever, then that somehow means I hate gay people or I hate transgender people, right? And it's like, I think that's where people are trying to avoid the conversation going. And like, you know, the first Bible verse they teach you, at least, you know, is like John 3:16. For God so loved the world, he gave his only begotten son, that whosoever believes in him, right, shall not perish, but have everlasting life. The key word in that phrase is whosoever, right? It's everybody. It's not if you're gay, if you're transgender, no, like whosoever includes them too. It includes everybody. And so I think this idea that somehow religion is exclusive, and I like a lot of religious people have made it such, which I don't think it should be. And then there's also this message of condemnation of like, oh, if you do this or you drink that or you went here or you did that, like you're a bad person and you're evil. And then like the very next verse that nobody teaches you in children's church is John 3:17, which says like the Son of Man was not sent to condemn the world, but to save the world. And it's like the idea isn't, you know, condemnation and exclusivity. It's whosoever, everybody is included. And it's not about condemnation. It's about like saving people and helping people live a better life and have a, you know, better spiritual experience in existence. And I say that because I feel like the misunderstanding is why we're not listening to the rest of the story, because we think that a religious person is a person who hates these people or hates those people or doesn't like these people or has this against that person. But I think in truth, the religious person is someone who's, you know, not sent to condemn anybody. I don't have a heaven or a hell to send anybody to. Like, what am I going to do? Right. I'm just here to bear witness of what I've experienced. And here's what I've experienced. Here's what I've seen. And here's how, you know, God has impacted my life. And I'm just sharing that. I'm not necessarily trying to make somebody do or, you know, not do whatever. So I'll say that first. So what can podcasters do? I think one, understand that, right? Like, understand that the religious extremists out there don't speak for all religious people. And I think most of the religious people I've encountered within the phenomena or the UFO community, like we're the heretics of the religious community, right? Like we're the ones that are so far out there. We're talking to the UFO people. You know, we're not the ones that are like, you know, Bible bashing and, you know, condemning people. Like I think we're, you know, a different class. And I think being able to your point, 85% of the world is religious. And so like, it's not like Kelly that's going to get through to the religious community. It's people like me who play the piano at church or whose mom's a pastor and who can, you know, translate it into religious terminology and say, hey guys, like these people aren't bad. They aren't demonic. They just, you know, they're just having a testimony service over there, guys. That's all it is, you know, on Twitter. It's a testimony service on Twitter.
I love that.
And so I think if we want to include the world, like the religious perspective is a really important perspective to include. And I've had that conversation with people who are like, it's angels or it's demons and blah, blah, blah. And then we sit down, we have a talk about it. And I'm like, okay, well, what about this? What about that? What about this? What about that? And I'm like, okay, well, maybe you're right. Like, I, you know, like that was my knee-jerk reaction. But it's not Kelly Chase is going to be able to talk that person off the ledge, right? It's like, it's people like,
yeah, I don't know my Bible verses.
but in the same way, right? Like, it's you know, you need people like Gary Nolan to kind of put Neil deGrasse Tyson in check too, right? Like, to say, like, and put it in scientific terms that he understands. It's like, hey, you're not being a scientist, you're being a priest or whatever he said, right? Which I thought was hilarious. So I think we all need each other. And I think it's like, guys like me, it's part of my responsibility to be able to bring this topic into my community and bring a little bit of my topic into, you know, this community, right? Like, and show you guys the parallels and the similarities. And there is a lot of parallels. And, you know, like, I guess the one thing I tweeted, I think you retweeted this, Kelly, was just like, the people that say they don't believe in NHI, but they believe in, but people that say they don't believe in angels, but believe in benevolent NHI, is like saying you don't believe in water, but you believe in H2O, you know? It's like, just because you call it something slightly different doesn't mean we're not probably talking about the same thing, you know, with the same characteristics. And whether you call it water, or you call it H2O, or you call it an angel, or you call it, you know, benevolent NHI, like, there's still data embedded in those terms. When I say water, Jay, you know what I mean, you know, but if I'm talking to a scientist, I might have to talk about H2O, and maybe I need to make that pure H2O and remove all the impurities of it. Like, and that means something too, but we're really talking pretty much about the same thing. And I think we shouldn't let the religious terminology scare us. We should, you know, understand it. And you know, the religious community has been talking about this for 5,000 years, guys. Like, it wasn't like, you know, the UFO community just started talking about abductions in the 60s, right? Like, and, mm-hmm. you know, you go back to Genesis 6 and there's, you know, NHI coming down and hybridizing with humans, right? And so why not learn from that and take from that and incorporate that, as opposed to assuming that, you know, what we've learned in the last 15 minutes is all there is to know.
I think that's a great perspective. And, you know, even if people don't, you know, bristle at the idea of exact matches, and there's all sorts of reasons for that, you know, it does open up the conversation among different communities to be able to open up data points to the point where we can have the conversations about comparing and contrasting and really looking at overlap, looking at differences, and having dialogue such that we can tease out what the subtleties are there and what the nuances are there, right? So along those lines, you know, in a kind of a broad way, and maybe this is like too big of a question, too much of a big picture view, but along the lines of what you're talking about, you know, maybe a good place to start landing the conversation here today is, what does the phenomenon tell us about who we are as human beings? You know, given all of these frameworks that we've been talking about today and in the last episode, you know, given your family history, given your personal history, given the context of the ranch, given the context of your ancestors, given the religious and spiritual frameworks, you know, what does the phenomenon tell us about who we are as human beings?
Yeah, I think what it tells us is that we're no longer who we were, right? And if you go deep on the UFO side, you know, it's all about human potential, right? It's, you get into the telepathy tapes, and you get into psychokinesis, and you get into remote viewing, and you get into non-locality and bilocation, and all of these amazing things that we can do with our consciousness as human individuals that somehow, some way we've lost. Maybe it's the glyphosate in our food, or maybe it's the, you know, the societal structure, the education system, you know, the toxins, whatever, the microplastics, like something happened to us that, you know, disconnected us from, you know, let's just call it the collective consciousness. And I think, you know, I think UFO community would agree with that. Well, if you go in the religious community, they say the same thing. They say, like, the fall of man disconnected us from God, which substitute collective consciousness, and that, you know, we used to be able to live longer and we could have these special abilities and we were more closer to angels than we are to where we are now. We've lost side of ourselves. And, you know, and part of this, you know, religious experience is to be able to, you know, draw that connection back and, you know, build back some of those spiritual gifts. And we talk about spiritual gifts, right? And so it's like, guys, like, we're saying the exact same thing, like, again, like, and so I think, you know, I said, what is the phenomena about? I think it's about human potential, you know, if you want to put it in secular terms, or it's about, you know, connecting with the higher power. If you want to put it in religious terms, it's about, you know, humans becoming who we once were and achieving our full potential, you know, and that full potential is more, obviously there's physical elements to that, right? Diana talks about the protocols and such, which are shockingly sound a lot like, you know, religious practices, right? But there's also this spiritual component or consciousness component or soul component, like however you want to quantify or whatever you want to call that non-physical part of our human existence. It seems to be about that. And it seems to be about, you know, being kind to each other, not because of the performative thing, but, you know, Kelly, you said something once, like, you said something like, you know, you feel like you were doing damage to your soul or something like that. Like, and I think that's what this is all about, right? I think that's what this whole 3D matrix simulated, you know, experience is, right? Like, because if you take it from a religious perspective, like the Bible says, God knew you before you were born. So meaning that you existed pre, you know, 3D body, earth, you know, and that you'll exist post, right? And that this existence is, you know, here for us to learn and grow and reconnect, right? And I think the UFO community kind of feels the same way. Like, it's like, okay, is this a simulation? Is this just a 4D projection down to a 3D reality? Our consciousness is, you know, survives. Like, we're all saying pretty much the same thing. And we might have different names, but at the end of the day, I think it's about the non-physical portion of human existence and how to cultivate that and make that better. And in so doing, you make the physical better and you make it better for all of, you know, your human companions on trapped on this, you know, simulated 3D rock, you know, existence.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
I love that. You know, something that you said that day on the ranch that stuck with me, speaking of listening to different perspectives, because like I don't have kids, Jay doesn't have kids. You know, I was asking you what you hoped people would take away from your story. And one of the very first things you said was that you hoped that people would listen to their kids. And that was like, for whatever reason, I wasn't expecting that to be the answer. And I think you have so many reasons. The fact that you listen to your children and to your oldest son in particular is such a huge part of this story. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about why it's so important you to listen to your kids and how that really played into this overall story.
Yeah. So I'll talk about why, then I'll tell you some examples. I think why it's important is you have to understand, like, kids are at a, especially young kids, right? They're like pure, right? They're not trying to manipulate you. They don't have a profit motive. They're not just making up a story for entertainment most of the time. They're coming from a pure place and they genuinely love you and care about you. And so I think there's, you know, they say there's two people that'll be honest with you. It's like a drunk person and a child, right? And, you know, so I guess you should listen to drunk people too. But listen to your kids. And I say that because I think a lot of times kids will tell you things, but we as adults, because it doesn't comport to our reality, we write it off. You know, your kid tells you about a dream, or they tell you they saw a monster outside their window, or they tell you, you know, all sorts of things that kids say. And parents, instead of listening and trying to understand and maybe even investigating, they just write it off and say, oh, there's nothing outside your window. You know, Jay, you didn't see that. You know, that didn't happen. That's not real. And then, you know, you stifle that child and you don't get to, you know, understand and fully grasp the reality. So in the case of listening to my kids, I'll give you like a couple examples that happened before the dream about, you know, his great-great-grandfather who said he had a message for me and kind of led us to the ranch, right? So like, why would I even listen to that first, right? Because there was other things that happened. One of them was he had been having this series of like dreams and, you know, if you want to call them nightmares, fine. But like as a parent, like parents, you know what a nightmare is. I mean, you know, like there's a whole nother level when a child is like hysterical, like it's not a nightmare. It's not a dream to them. It's reality. And so he was going through this series of this to the point to where I didn't even sleep in the bedroom anymore. Like I was sleeping on the couch because I wanted to be close to, you know, his room and kind of be able to, you know, help him get back to bed and just make sure nothing was going on. And, you know, so one night he just wakes up hysterical. It's probably like 2-3 in the morning and he's just screaming. He just like, mommy, mommy, mommy's hurt. Mommy's hurt. You got to go check on mommy. Your mommy's hurt. And I'm like, Logan, like mommy's fine. Like she's in the room. Like everything's cool. And he's like hysterical, like alligator tears, crying. He's like, no, you don't understand. You got to go check on mommy. Go get mommy. And I'm like, Logan, like mommy's fine. And he's just like, it's not taking no for an answer. I'm like, okay. Come with me. I'm going to carry downstairs. We're going to go see mommy and show you that she's fine. Everything's okay. So I take him, you know, downstairs. We go into the room. My wife's like, I'm fine. Everything's cool. Don't worry. Go back to sleep, whatever. So I put him to sleep on the couch, you know, because I didn't want to walk all the way back upstairs and have to keep back up and down. So I'm like, fine, go to sleep on the couch. I'm going to sit here. Now, at this point, I'm like wide awake because you're, you know, I think it was like maybe 4 at the time. Your four-year-old is like, you know, screaming bloody murder in the middle of the night. And I'm sitting there just on my phone at like 3:30 in the morning. And I see my wife calls me. And this is maybe 20 minutes after, you know, this all transpired with the dream. She calls me. And I'm like, why is she calling me from the other room? She could have just like yelled my name. Like, why is she calling my phone? That's so weird. So I answer the phone. And I'm like, hello. And all I hear in the other line is her saying, help, help. And I'm just like, what? So I just jumped up. I run into the room. And everything Logan had described in his dream, he said, you know, she was crying in the bed and she was shaking and she couldn't move and she needed help. And I go in the room 20 minutes later and she's shaking and crying and, you know, convulsing and needing help. I'm like thinking she's having a seizure at the time. So I'm like, holy crap. I call my mom, like, I don't have time to explain. Get over here right now. I got to call, you know, Chrissy's hurt or whatever. Call 911. Paramedics come to the house, you know, like, you know, they come in the door, you know, freaking sirens ringing, waking up all my neighbors. I'm sure they thought, like, I don't know what they thought. And they come in the room, and then turns out she was going into, and I'm not a doctor, but I want to say it was like some type of sepsis shock or something, where she had gotten an infection that had gotten into her bloodstream. And I don't know if I'm like HIPAA violations now, but, you know, she had gotten this infection anyway, got in her bloodstream. And so, you know, paramedics are there. And the thing about it is like, because I was sleeping on the couch and I had been working, my phone was on silent. And if I hadn't, like, if Logan hadn't had that dream, I wouldn't have probably woken up. And like, she didn't have enough strength to actually yell from the other room. And if she had called me and I was passed out sleep with my phone on silent, I don't think I would have, you know, answered. And so it's almost like this whole thing happened to put me in an alert and awake state 20 minutes before this happened so that I could be there to help her. And she's fine now, obviously. And so that was just one example, right? Like, so if that happens and then your kid has another dream, you're going to be like, okay, dude, like, what is your dream this time, right? And so I just think you have to listen to your kids because you never know what they're going to be telling you. Do you want another one? I got another one, TLA, if you want another.
Yeah, go for it.
Okay. Okay, this is a crazy one. So, again, this is during the same period where we had moved to this new house, and, like, ever since we moved in, it was just, like, chaos. To the point to where I thought somebody was living in our house. Like, I genuinely thought, like, somebody was, like, in the attic or, like, you know, you would hear things. And, I mean, we even had, you know, pastor come and bless the house and try to, like, get evil spirits out, the whole thing. And particularly what's happening in my son's bedroom. And so again, I put him to bed that night and I'm go downstairs to the couch And I'm just like hoping he stays in his bed because he didn't want to stay in his bed. We're trying to get him to sleep in his bed. And I just hear playing and he's upstairs and he's like playing. And I'm like, okay, do I like get mad at him and tell him to go to bed? I'm like, well, he's in his room. Like, at least I won half the battle. He'll eventually get tired and go to sleep. I'll just sit here and just like listen and monitor. And so I'm just sitting there listening. I hear him playing. And then it sounds like he's playing with someone, you know, and he's like laughing and giggling. And it's just like this, you know, it's this dynamic of like what sounded to me like two people like upstairs playing. I'm like, who the heck is in my room? Like, maybe like somebody was like, I'm thinking like somebody was like hiding in our house, like, and is now upstairs in the room, like playing my son. So I like freak out and he's laughing, having a great time. And like, I'm like, okay, I got to go up there. So like, I jump off the couch, I run up the stairs. And as I get to the top of the stairs, I hear him start like screaming, like a blood curling scream, like something terrible had just happened. And I see and hear him scream and that turns into a cry. And so I'm like sprinting down the hallway at this point, like bust open the door. I go in there and like look around. I see all these toys on the floor and he's just like bawling, like crying alligator tears. And I'm like looking like to try to like choke somebody out, right? Like, cause I'm thinking like there's somebody in the room, like checking the window, if they get out the window. And I'm like, what happened? What's going on? And he goes, he's like, Dad, I was playing with my sister and then God came and said that I can't play with her anymore and that she has to go back to heaven. Now, mind you, at this point, we had a miscarriage. We hadn't even told any of our family about it. We didn't tell Logan about it. And he had been talking about his sister for like, you know, months. I mean, he'd be riding back to the car saying, I'm talking to my sister. And whenever he would talk about his sister, like me and Christy would just kind of like, you know, look at each other, kind of give us each other that look, almost like, okay, this is confirmation, like that this child still is with us. And like, you know, but then he was just so distraught that he is like, God came and told me that I can't play with my sister anymore and that she has to go back to heaven. And he was just absolutely wrecked. And he never even knew we had a miscarriage. And like, I don't know how you explain that. And I don't know if like I triggered it when I like jumped up and was like gonna go check on him, you know. But clearly something had happened to him at that point. And so like, you know, if he says that, then what do? You're gonna be like, you know, next time he says something, you're gonna listen, you know. I mean, there's more, but, you know, I know we got limited time, but.
He's a special kid. He really
is. Yeah.
He absolutely is. And thank you so much for sharing that. It's really profound. How are your anomalous experiences connected to a sense of meaning and purpose in your life? We've been kind of circling around this a bit throughout both of these episodes.
Okay, so I'll maybe elaborate a little bit more on this one. We talked about the horse accident when I was a kid, right? I hesitate to talk about some of it because I'm like, it's like nobody's gonna believe if I say this, right? According to my uncle, who was at the park with me that day, he says the horse stepped on me. Now, if you have a 1,000-pound animal stepping on a 3-4-year-old kid, like, it's game, set, match. He says the horse stepped on me. Like, there were no evidence, you know, at the doctor that happened. In fact, the doctor was like, this kid doesn't even like he fell down, let alone got hit by a horse, right? The other thing that I didn't really articulate well was that what I remember running. I was running to my uncle, trying to get there. But I mean, it's a horse. He's running way faster than you as a kid. And I just remember looking up and I remember seeing the white part of the horse's chest right here. And then everything went black. But the interesting thing about that, and then, you know, then I kind of saw the event unfolding from like 10 feet up. And I know it was like 10 feet up because I was like by the basketball hoop, right? The interesting thing about that was that like, it was like I went out before the horse hit me, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. It wasn't like I got hit and then, you know, like I blacked out. It was like I saw it coming and blacked out before it hit me. Cause like, I don't really remember any pain. I don't remember it like actually making contact. It was almost like a hair before that happened, or maybe, you know, knocked my memory out. I don't know. But, and the doctors were like, you know, baffled, like this doesn't even make any sense at all. My grandmother at the time, she says, now again, this is her story, not mine, but she says that she fainted around this time. And that when she fainted, she could see what was happening. And that, I don't even, like, I, she says that she was, you know, trying to block the horse's feet, like, while from stepping on me, and like almost serving as like a barrier, you know, from him stepping on me. I don't know. Like, I was 3-4 years old. All I know is, I know I got hit by the horse. I know I went to the hospital. I know what I saw from my vantage point. And the impossibility of, like, what my uncle describes of actually me being physically stepped on, and my grandmother saying, like, she fainted and was, like, I don't even know what you call it, but, like, put in some kind of barrier between me and this horse, like, in some metaphysical realm. I don't know. Like, I know I'm still alive, right? And I know that after that experience, I felt like I had to, you know, live life a certain way. And I think that's also what caused me to have more of a religious perspective in life, because I realized, like, there was more to life, and, like, that there was another realm, and that there was, you know, like, just more to our existence than just the physical. And it just happened to me really early. And I don't know what to make of that, right? Like, I don't know if that's, if what my grandma says is true, if my uncle missaw something. I know I got hit by a horse. Like, I know that, you know? And so that's, you know, more than enough. And I know the sense I got after that event, I don't have any medical proof, like, that, like, I had a near-death experience or whatever at that point, but the feeling that I felt and the reaction, like, my mom had, and, like, it just, it changes you. And I don't think it has, I mean, it has to change you. If you don't come back, change from like that, I don't know what's wrong with you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I identify with so much of that. This has been such an incredible conversation. Before we sign off and say goodbye to everybody, I wanted to ask you, like, if there's just one thing, your story is so, it's expansive, and there's so many different aspects to it. But if there was one thing that people could take away from your story, what would that be?
I think it's more to life than what meets the eye. And it's okay to investigate that and, you know, figure out where you land on that. I think if my story doesn't, I don't want to say convince you, but doesn't provide at least a glimmer that there's more to the everyday existence than what meets the eye, then I don't know what will, frankly. And it's okay to investigate it. I'm not saying you have to go and join my church and, you know, do all that. You know, I'm just saying, like, investigate it. Listen to your children. Like, you know, find out more. You know, ask questions. Talk to your grandparents. Like, ask your parents about stuff. Like, think about the things that you've experienced that seem improbable. And I think what you'll learn is that there's more to reality than just these three dimensions and fourth dimension of time that we're kind of trapped in. And I think once you accept that and realize that, then all of a sudden all the possibilities open up, and you can choose how you want to engage with those possibilities. But I think to ignore it is to do yourself a disservice.
I love that. And thank you, Courtney. Thank you so much for being a part of Cosmosis. Thank you so much for being here on the podcast today. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Awesome. Thanks, Kelly. Thanks, Jay.
That's it for this episode. Cosmosis is brought to you by Ontocalypse Productions. If you want to check out our docuseries, Cosmosis, UFOs in a New Reality, head over to cosmosis.media to find out where to watch. Make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. And if you're watching on YouTube, don't forget to like this video, leave a comment, and ring the bell for notifications. It really helps the show and keeps the conversations going. Music for the Cosmosis Conversations is by Michael Rubino. The soundtrack for Season 1 of Cosmosis is now available on all major music streaming platforms, and you'll find links in the episode description. If you want to go even deeper and support our work, join us on Patreon. You'll get early access to ad-free episodes, exclusive behind-the-scenes content, and monthly Zoom calls with us and special guests. You can sign up now at patreon.com/cosmosismedia. Join us next week for part one of our brand new, thought-provoking conversation with the legendary Whitley Strieber. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time.